This is an RTRFM podcast. RTRFM is a community organisation and relies on volunteer and listener support. To learn more about what we do, visit rtrfm.com.au.
This is a war between the government and the Tamil people.
I'm not a fucking terrorist. You are the terrorist.
People are crying out for justice in this country.
If you've got to be militant to achieve your aims and your aspirations, so be it.
There's a real hypocrisy from the big corporations.
The people from below will push for real change.
This Australia is going to be shocked, and then the public will say, what the hell's going on?
Good morning, and welcome to the Indie Media Show here on RTRFM 92.1, the sound alternative, with your host, Alex Wisson. Flying solo in the studio today, as I sometimes prefer it. I get a bit of peace and quiet away from my ratbag colleagues. No, I don't mean that. I hope my colleagues are doing well and enjoying this lovely Monday public holiday. Quite an intimate setting in the studio in the office today, public holiday, so not many people around. Jeff's there beavering away in the other studio. And, of course, a wonderful big thank you to Jeff Bullen for another fine edition of On The Record. And if we could just pat ourselves on the back for a moment, we are both here on a public holiday, so how good are we? And I hope you appreciate our efforts as volunteers here at RTRFM, the best community radio station in the world, if I can say so non-hyperbolically. And as Jeff said, it's still time to subscribe for Radiothon. If you are a big fan of community radio and independent voices, independent media and so forth, pop on the website. Not too late to subscribe to RTRFM. We would really appreciate it. Plenty coming up on the show today. Probably not too much time for editorialising, even though there's plenty to discuss editorially speaking. Where does one even begin with the horrific atrocities in Lebanon? Just unbelievable in terms of the technical aspects of it. That's perhaps a ghoulish observation, but very impressive at a technical, technological level, what the Mossad intelligence agency has achieved, if I can use that term. But of course, that's a ghoulish way of describing it, because what we're talking about is the murder of at least 40 people and the injury of thousands of others through, it seems, a form of a nitrate explosive, very powerful explosive, between 1 and 3 grams of this explosive being added to pagers and walkie-talkies throughout Lebanon. And goes without saying, I'm sure that the listeners, you're savvy enough to recognise that the mainstream media reporting of these atrocities, obviously grossly misleading. The headline figures have referred to Hezbollah pages and Hezbollah walkie-talkies, which all the evidence clearly indicates is a nonsense. There are doctors that were killed, there were children, there were medical staff, there were radio operators, all kinds of other people who were either injured or killed as a result of this attack by Israel, which is kind of obvious when you think about it for 3 seconds. Like, if you're adding explosives to a consignment of pages or walkie-talkies, there's clearly no guarantee that 100% of those items are going to fall into the hands of Hezbollah fighters. But be that as it may, obviously it's a war crime that Israel has conducted on top of its mountain of war crimes that it's carried out throughout its entire existence. Of course, the latest news as well is that Israeli forces, Israeli soldiers have raided the Al Jazeera offices in Ramallah and shut down its media license, even though it's actually the Palestinian Authority that nominally provides that broadcasting license to Al Jazeera. So just wanton military aggression by Israel, and just turning back to Lebanon briefly, further bombings in Beirut, killing a senior Hezbollah commander, as well as Radwan officers from their Radwan Special Forces unit. So clearly a whole series of actions by Israel designed to provoke a reaction from Hezbollah, presumably with a view to having a casus belli to launch a full-scale war, which it appears almost certainly is what Netanyahu and his cabinet want, is a full-scale regional war. And it would appear that nobody is going to stop him. Another topic worth discussing. It was actually sort of breaking news as we were going to air last week. Is this a second apparent assassination attempt on Trump? Not too much one can say about it, and that's kind of the story in itself, is that it's a little bit like the first assassination attempt. It's very strange the way it quickly dropped off the headlines, even though it's an event of major significance and could set off a complete firestorm in the United States. Clearly, if either of those attempts are successful, the United States right now would be in an even more chaotic state than it already is, and that's saying something. But so a very curious story, and like I say, there's not much one can say about it because precious little detail has been released by the Secret Service or the FBI. It's just this kind of very murky, you know, rather confusing story about a guy hiding in the bushes for 12 hours, didn't get off a shot, not clear what his motivations are, other than some connection with his support for the Ukrainian war effort and a perception on his part that Trump didn't support adequately the Ukrainian war effort. And that's about all we know about this would-be assassin. So obviously lots of questions remain unanswered, not least of which is obviously the abject failure of the Secret Service on both of these occasions, which is perhaps understandably, you know, not just among Trump supporters, but just among a lot of people, led to all kinds of speculations about why the Secret Service would fail so abysmally in you know, basically the one job it has, which is to protect the senior officials and former presidents of the United States. So anyway, lots of questions remain answered, and I'm sure we will explore that topic further at some later date, and no doubt there'll be further twists and turns and dramatic developments in this presidential election campaign as we enter the final stretch towards the first Tuesday of November. But as I say, plenty coming up on the show here on the Indie Media Show. We're going to be hearing a report from our own Joni Boyd. There's a rally outside State Parliament on Thursday calling for the closure of Unit 18, the now notorious, juvenile detention system. What it actually is a maximum security, or it's a wing for juveniles in the maximum security adult prison of Casuarina, holding up to 20 juvenile inmates, supposedly a temporary a solution for supposedly, you know, highly problematic inmates at Banksia Hill. That temporary solution's been going on for nearly 2.5 years now, and there's been a second death in custody there in Unit 18, and it's a second death in custody in the last 10 months. So Joni will bring us that report. And we're also going to be speaking to Professor Richard Tanter. Professor Tanter is a Senior Research Associate with the Nautilus Institute, a long-term international relations academic, and a spokesperson for the Independent and Peaceful Australia Network, which is hosting a conference in Perth coming up next month. So I had a chance to chat with Richard a little earlier this morning about that upcoming conference, as well as AUKUS, which had its third year anniversary. Not a happy one, I don't believe. And, you know, discussing the strategic implications of AUKUS and how much of a threat the AUKUS Security Pact, you know, may be to peace in the Asia-Pacific region. So all that coming up here on the Indie Media Show. Do stay tuned.
This Australia is going to be shocked, and then the public will say, what the hell's going on?
You're back with the Indie Media Show with your host, Alex Wisson. On Thursday, Borloo Justice held a rally outside State Parliament to demand the closure of Unit 18 after the death of a second child in youth detention there last month. And that's the second child to die in custody at Unit 18 in the past 10 months. Our own Joni Boyd was there at the steps of Parliament House and brings us this report.
This story contains the name of an Aboriginal person who has died, and it also contains descriptions of prison violence, self-harm and suicide. Last year, 16-year-old Cleveland Dodd died in custody after self-harming in Unit 18, a youth detention facility in Casuarina Prison, hastily converted from a maximum security unit. Cleveland was kept in his cell for 22 hours a day. There were no resources for monitoring suicide risks in the prison, and Cleveland had made several threats of self-harm. Youth correctional officers made false records of welfare checks on the teenager, yet the coronial inquest into Cleveland's death found there was no misconduct. Now, late last month, a 17-year-old boy, whose name is being kept private by family, died by suicide 2 days after being taken to Banksia Hill. Authorities claim the boy showed no signs of being a suicide risk, but legal workers who spoke to him say he was previously in Unit 18, experienced prolonged solitary confinement, and self-harmed and attempted suicide in that facility. So this is the second death by suicide in WA youth detention in less than a year, coming after a prolonged period of community and institutional protest against Unit 18 and Banksia Hill for inhumane treatment against child detainees. Last Thursday, Boolu Justice and the Justice for Cleveland Dodd campaign staged a rally at Parliament House, calling on the state to close Unit 18 and for an overhaul of the youth justice system in favour of community-led alternatives. About 100 ralliers turned up to Parliament with signs saying, "Kids on country, not in cages. Build communities, not prisons. Black Lives Matter, and close Unit 18. I was down there and captured the voices of speakers and protesters, including Mudich Mag's Jim Morrison, Pop Ben Taylor, and Fiona Stanley.
We're here for one thing. Shut down Unit 18. Yeah. Our people are dying, these young people. Shouldn't be happening. I remember the days when we had thousands of people on this walk here. They all stopped in silence, and we're still here. I'm the last one standing. I'm in my middle 80s now, and, you know, it saddens me to see my people cry for our loved ones. Wow. So we must know why I did it. Now we must all stick together and let the world know how we've been treated. You know, it's bad. I will always stand in the front line with my people to stand for justice, because that's what we need. What do we want?
Justice!
What do we want? It?
Now!
Yeah, do you want to have a little chat about what's brought you out here today?
Yes, we are here today. We are calling for the close of Unit 18 immediately. They have made a decision to rush Unit 18 through without consultation with the community. They thought they knew answers. Now look where it got them. Now look where it got our young Kulungas in there. That's losing the battle, putting them in barbaric solitary confinement. That's not right. Their human rights are being compromised. They rushed that through. Now they can rush it to close it. Rush it straight down now, close it down tomorrow. Simple.
My name is Carly Douglas. I'm here today just as a mum who loves all of her children unconditionally, a mum who's worked her whole life to give her children the very best I could at the time, a mum who's made mistakes, a mum who learned as she grew with her babies, a mum who found herself visiting one of those babies in Banksia Hill. And I had to visit him in there for 3.5 years before he begged a magistrate to transfer him into an adult prison after being kept in the isolation unit of Banksia Hill for 406 consecutive days. That's longer than a year. My boy now bears self-harming scars that completely cover his arms. Arms that once wrapped around me for a big hug. Everything the children jailed in Unit 18 and Banksia Hill are saying is absolutely true, and I know this because it happened to my son. In May 2017 in Banksia, my son protested against the rolling lockdowns, the lack of out-of-hours cells, and the mistreatment of detainees, along with six others. The department labelled this a riot, when in fact it was a protest. Kids in Banksia and Unit 18 don't riot for nothing. You treat a child like an animal and eventually they'll bite like one. I do not condone my boy's actions, but I don't condemn him for standing up for himself and others to a regime that showed no mercy, who exploited children without support. After the boys were rounded up at gunpoint that day, after they were pepper sprayed, flash bombed, assaulted and hogtied, they were taken to the isolation unit for the kids who were not suitable for the general population. There the power and water was turned off. That night was the beginning of my son's 406 consecutive days in that isolation unit. That night and many more to come, my boy was denied a mattress, bedding, water to drink, a shower, medical attention, and the list goes on. For the next year, this treatment continued. His shutters were kept down in the cell so he couldn't see the daylight. He was made to kneel on the cell floor to receive food. He wasn't permitted to have hot food for a time. He was handcuffed and shackled when he left his cell for family visits. He was constantly illegally strip searched. He was mocked by screws, restrained by the hog tie method on many occasions. He was denied showers, shoes, clothes. He was paraded around the facility in handcuffs as an example to other kids. During this year, my son began to self-harm a lot. I was never informed about this until I noticed his arms one very hot summer day in my visits when he removed his sweater. This broke mine and my husband's hearts into pieces. This was not what he deserved. This is not what any child deserves or should endure.
So I had the opportunity to give evidence at the coronial inquest for Cleveland Dodd. I was able to present the research done by the Talon Fund Kids under the supervision of Professor Carol Bauer and an amazing team of people. The study was to look at the level of disability that existed within Banksia Hill. There were also studies done to look at whether the staff had the training and capacity to look after children with these disabilities. And the results are absolutely stunning. And they make the strong case for never locking up these children. They looked at these children, and nearly 90% of these children had a major developmental disability, which meant that they were not able to cope with even understanding, perhaps, what was being spoken to them in the children's court. They weren't able to listen. Many of them were speaking other language, other than Aboriginal language, other than English, and would not understand it. And many of them had speech problems as well. They also had medical problems that weren't being attended to, such as ear disease and other infections, and many of them had substance abuse. The other points I want to make is that only two of the children that they examined had been assessed before they were incarcerated. But most of the children already had early life trauma. And if we had thought about the pathways of these children into Banksia, they start before birth, of course, but they start during pregnancy. They start at birth. There were multiple opportunities for health, education, child protection, justice, police, to have assessed these children before they went in. So this is a big ask we have. Look at all the incredibly successful Aboriginal-run diversionary programs that we have in this state, most of them underfunded, but most of them really, really successful. I could give you many examples. Julie Coffin is doing a wonderful horse empathy program up in Broome and Horse Creek. Nearly 3,000 children have gone through this program. And then they don't end up in detention. They'll end up on a pathway to success. So it is incredibly important that we make put these data out so that people know how important they are.
Oh, what brought you out here today?
Oh, I think that...
Buy me lunch.
I think that what's happening in Western Australia is a disgrace in a number of ways, but especially with Unit 18 and Banksia Hill, the government have just been told over and over and over again that it needs to be shut down immediately, that there are horrific risks to people's lives, to people's health, but also to families and to culture from this remaining open. It's just unconscionable, but here we are, it remains open, and it's something that they could easily do. They could easily change this, and it would make a real difference to people's lives, and yet they refuse to.
We've lost two boys. We have tragically lost two boys. Two boys in that place of dishevelment, a shithole, of a corral of human misery in a holding pen. It breaks my soul that we have to live in this harrow, and we have to take out the grim reality of what there is, because if we don't, nothing will change. Since 1997, there have been 20,000 kids, more than 20,000 kids, going through Banksia Hill. 16,000 of those children have gone on to adult incarceration, ruined lives. Their hearts are aching. they're longing, they've seen suffering and disadvantage from the beginning of life. Those 16,000 children that finished up as adults in adult incarceration in the 17 prisons in Western Australia. Well, there are also 100 children post-release from Banksia in those years since 1997 until most recently. 100 children, the majority of them have died by suicide. All these dead children by overdoses and misadventure, but the majority by suicide. They're post-release, they're deaths after custody. I know a lot of these children, I've worked with them, I've supported them. They've never been dangerous. They've got specialist needs. They need love and nurture.
I'm here today to tell you that the solutions to the challenges that we face across the nation, and particularly in Western Australia, the solutions come from our people, the people with the lived experiences. Not these mob and the officers here and the bureaucrats that run the systems that do shut us out, that are developed and created by non-Aboriginal folk for our people. It does not work. You look at closing the gap data, all of the indicators but one is going a trajectory down. And why is that? Because these mob and the feds are still paying non-Aboriginal organisations to have solutions for our people. They do not work. We know better. Our kids know better. Our kids are amazing people with so many unique characteristics and strengths. One of the things we do at Koya is to teach them, take these glasses off, throw them away. We're going to teach you to see yourself with positivity, with the strengths and the qualities that you have to build and thrive, not develop, but thrive in your community.
In educating stolen people, it's quite an effort, and we've released a documentary called Genocide in the Wildflower State. And it is talking about eugenics and epigenetics, which is what our kids are suffering from today, epigenetics, the intergenerational trauma. A couple of months ago, we did a screening at Banksia Hill, and I was overwhelmed by these young men just spellbound on this documentary about genocide, eugenics, epigenetics. They got it. These young people who are treated like animals sat spellbound at what they heard. In fact, a young man said to me, he said, "Uncle, I smashed my nana's house up twice. I smashed my nana's house up twice. Uncle, now I know what she went through. Uncle, I will never damage that house again." So the truth has got to lead to justice. It's got to lead to healing.
That last speaker you heard from there was RTRFM's own Jim Morrison from Morditch Mag, speaking at that rally demanding the closure of Unit 18, the so-called juvenile detention facility that's actually housed at a maximum security adult jail at Casuarina Prison. And I don't know about you, but you know, several powerful speakers there. Jerry Georgiadis was another one. Heed their message. I mean, it feels like a broken record, this stuff, in terms of restorative, rehabilitative justice rather than punitive forms of incarceration. We've certainly been talking about it for at least 15 years on this show, if not longer. So, yeah, the dam's got to break at some point in this state. So thanks so much to Joni for that report.
You're listening to the Indie Media Podcast, first broadcast on RTRFM 92.1.
You're back with the Indie Media Show with your host Alex Wesson on RTRFM 92.1, the sound alternative. If you've got any comments, criticisms, story suggestions, ideas, or you just want to have a bit of a chin wag, time permitting, do feel free to give us a call in the studio. The number is 9260 9210, or alternatively send us an email, studio@rtrfm.com.au. And be sure to follow the Indie Media Show on all of the corporate social media channels like Facebook. And importantly, we have a huge archive going up to nearly 1,000 interviews on our SoundCloud page as well. China continues to behave aggressively, testing us all across the region. So said the lame duck United States President Joe Biden, caught in a so-called hot mic moment when discussing China and how China is to be combated among the so-called Quad, which is Japan, India, Australia, and the United States. And that is about as transparent a comment as you're likely to get from Biden. One of the more coherent comments as well he might make, which, yeah, just sort of reveals the true nature of these Western security alliances, which anyone with a functional brain sort of understands beneath all of the highfalutin rhetoric and PR guff of democracy and human rights and making international waters navigable for free trade and commerce. These are all fairy tales that I don't think even children believe. It's sort of a nonsense, a calculated, fabricated nonsense. As I say, like the stories that you tell to small children, which even small children won't believe. Because, of course, what all of this Western military security architecture is about trying to secure a second American century global supremacy for the United States imperialism. It's 800 bases in 90 countries throughout the world, using craven allies and lieutenants like, Australia to do its bidding in pursuing those aggressive goals of, maintaining global imperial supremacy as opposed to the rising superpower of China. And that, of course, brings us to the subject of AUKUS, which celebrated, I suppose, hawks and warmongers and psychopaths might think, but mourned by others, that the 3 years of this new military partnership bring us ever closer to a regional interstate major war with China and its allies, and that much is obvious to anyone who analyses these matters. And one person who analyses these matters in great detail and is indeed as an expert is international relations academic, senior research associate with the Nautilus Institute and spokesperson for the Independent, Peaceful and Australia Network, Professor Richard Tanter. Had the opportunity to chat with Professor Tanter a little earlier this morning, and I began by asking him about the work of IPAN and just how important it is as a campaigning organisation.
Well, I think the name shows pretty clearly what it is. It stands for an independent Australia and a peaceful Australia, and it is very much a network. It's now been going for a bit over 10 years, I think maybe 11 or 12, and it's grown, particularly in that time, and I think it's bringing together a very diverse range of other groups as a network and being fairly effective in really beginning to hold first the Morrison government and then the Albanese government to account for some of the decisions that have been made which are pulling us more closely in a direction which is, well, not peaceful, and in particular brings us into the risk of war with China. So I think that at the moment that's the most important thing that IPAN is doing.
Certainly, and you're quite right to say that IPAN is an umbrella organisation that brings together a lot of campaigning groups, and we've seen activities against AUKUS here in Perth that have involved anti-nuclear campaigners as well as peace campaigners, Palestine solidarity campaigners, and so on. If we can come on to AUKUS itself, which is clearly one of the focuses for IPAN and anti-war activists generally. Earlier this month marked the third anniversary of the forming of the AUKUS Security Pact. The headline figure or headline story about AUKUS has been the gargantuan $368 billion price tag attached to the submarines that Australia will allegedly have in its arsenal in the next few years. But AUKUS goes beyond that, doesn't it, Richard? Can you paint a bit of a picture of exactly what AUKUS is, beyond the submarine deals, because there's a lot more involved in that security pact, isn't there?
Well, yes, it is. And a whole lot has emerged about gotten away in the last few years, particularly focusing on AUKUS and submarines, but going beyond that, that Australia has signed up to a number of agreements with the United States. You might call them AUKUS plus. The submarines are particularly troubling for the reasons you've outlined. But going beyond that, we're signing up to establish submarine bases to be used by US and UK submarines in both your state and on the East Coast. We have signed up to expand our most important northernmost airbase, which is RAF Base Tyndall outside Katherine in the Northern Territory, particularly to accommodate B-52 strategic heavy bombers, which are nuclear capable. And this is part of an overall shift, the submarines being one part, B-52s and other airbase expansions being another, which take Australia much closer to direct military support for US nuclear operations from Australia. In other words, that submarines that could be based at HMAS Stirling will in the first instance certainly be supporting as attack submarines, assisting the United States to try and counter Chinese ballistic missile submarines in the South China Sea and East China Sea. In the case of B-52s, whether they are conventionally armed or nuclear armed, but of course the government won't tell us one way or the other, they are a very serious threat to China, and China will probably respond as we would with a threat to us. So we're really expanding our range of support for nuclear operations from the old days, and still today, that Pine Gap provides intelligence and command and control for nuclear missile operations, and or assists nuclear missile operations by providing targets. Northwest Cape provides communications to ballistic missile submarines and so forth. So if you like, AUKUS and AUKUS Plus is a range of ways in which Australia is cooperating with the United States on a range of alliance fronts, which bring us much more directly involved with military operations around the world, and in particular, potentially nuclear weapons operations.
You've already addressed the topic to some degree, Professor Tanta, but what would you say to the devil's advocate argument that some people might be sympathetic with, that yes, there's an enormous price tag attached to AUKUS, and yet again it sees us really, you know, standing shoulder to shoulder with the United States, but actually that's a price worth paying, because it will ensure the defence of Australia's territorial sovereignty. That's certainly the way it's being sold to the Australian public. But you've already sort of outlined there, I think, why that's not the case. There's a former Australian Army intelligence officer, Clint Fernandez, who has, and he's not the only one to make this argument, made the claim that AUKUS is really all about making Australian forces interoperable, is the word he used, interoperable with American and NATO forces. In other words, purchasing these submarines and so forth, all the other components of AUKUS, has nothing to do with the territorial defence of Australia, and everything about an aggressive forward posture, as you say, in the South China Sea, really threatening potentially World War III and an aggressive stance towards China. So, I mean, what would you say to that argument, though, that people might say, well, we need an agreement of this kind in order to defend Australia?
Look, I think it's very good to think these things through with a devil's argument kind, advocacy kind of argument. And certainly all defence policies of any kind have costs one way or another, either in human terms or fiscal terms. You've got to pay for them. In the case of AUKUS and submarines, Clinton Fernandez is certainly right that it's about what the Americans call interoperability, which can range from a whole lot of things to, you know, do our radios work on the same frequencies, through to can our aircraft operate with American nuclear bombers, and our submarines operate with American submarines. That's quite true. However, the first thing is that there is not only no guarantee that spending $368 billion on the AUKUS submarines and the preparations for them, should that be the final cost, and it's most unlikely to be that, of course, over a 15, 20-year period, there is no guarantee whatsoever that that will, A, produce any improvement in our security, quite possibly the reverse, by making HMAS Stirling a target in the event of war. And secondly, there's no guarantee whatsoever that those submarines will ever be delivered. To be very clear, leaving aside the problems that the Americans are going to have allowing us, quote unquote, to have access to their second-hand Virginia submarines in the interim, or possibly one or two off their production line over the next 10 or 15 years, the so-called AUKUS submarines, which would be built by the British, which are due to be delivered in the late 2040s through to the late 2050s, they haven't even been designed. Now, I'm not a technical expert, but I do know that building submarines is a particularly complicated and difficult task. Designing them is very hard. And so we have agreed to an open-ended agreement in the long run to fork out $350 billion. I don't know whether you know what that actually means in spending terms. I don't, sure. It's beyond my ken. But in the meantime, we've signed over with literally a blank check to the American American government about $10 billion to subsidize the production of Virginia-class submarines. In other words, the ones the Americans have got now, which we would like to have one of if we could. Thank you very much. The point is, it was revealed in Senate estimates in earlier this year when the Green Senator, David Stockbridge, asked Admiral Meade, who's in charge of this project, oh, by the way, can you tell us a little bit about the contract for us to subsidize the production of Virginia-class submarines? If the Americans are unable to do it, will we get that $10 billion back? And the Admiral looked unbelievably embarrassed. In other words, they hadn't even thought through a clawback procedure for this very early stage of the AUKUS arrangements. In other words, there's a lot that's uncertain. I think the thing that I'm most certain of is that we probably won't get the submarines that we're talking about. B, they won't do the job that we're talking about, particularly in 2050, by which the undersea balance of power will have changed. And thirdly, they are really bringing great risk on us. In other words, diminishing rather than increasing our security. And I think those arguments are not just myself or Clinton Fernandez to academics, but we're lining up with Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull, Prime Minister Paul Keating, and most recently former Labor long-serving Foreign Minister Gareth Evans, who said this is simply the worst foreign policy decision he's ever seen.
Well, sorry to cut you off there, Richard, but that brings me on to my next question, that one hardly has to be a radical lefty to recognise that there are alternative pathways for an independent Australian foreign policy. It relates to IPAN being the independent and peaceful Australia network. As you say, former political luminaries, Labor statesmen like Gareth Evans and Paul Keating have spoken very passionately against AUKUS. And there's a wider question here, which goes back many decades in Australian politics, really, doesn't it? Which is the question of what an independent, truly independent Australian foreign policy would look like, one that isn't dependent on a craven relationship with the United States. It's perhaps outside of the remit of this interview, Richard, but what do you think an independent Australian foreign policy would look like, you know, free of the shackles of that that craven relationship with Washington?
An independent foreign policy doesn't mean you're isolated, you stand on your own, but you assess the terms, if you like, of how your interdependency fairly carefully and in a balanced way. Secondly, you don't align yourself with one superpower or the other. You try and make room for the possibility of a third way, if you like, a non-aligned way. That particularly is important in the current circumstance when we face something which has never happened in Australian history, which is where the imperial power that has protected us, so-called, the British, at the cost of two world wars and a great deal more, I should add, and then the American Empire, are being challenged by a major regional power, namely China. Now, the reality is that China is, in fact, militarily and strategically quite weak compared with the Americans, but obviously the way of the future is going to be really in our part of the world relating to China. So the fundamental independent foreign policy decision we have to take is to support, if you like, a way of thinking about security, not just for us, but in Southeast Asia and East Asia more generally, which does not align with China, but takes Chinese genuine national security interests into account. And one way to do that is to make sure that we don't line up with American planning for nuclear war against China, because, of course, that closes the option of being independent. The other thing to say, if we're going to spend vast amounts on this particular submarine project with all its risks, the problem is that, of course, that means very little will be left in the budget, the military budget, for quite genuine national security needs on behalf of the Army or the Air Force or indeed other parts of the Navy which would be dedicated to actually defending Australia. So in other words, we enfeeble our defence that way. So an independent and peaceful Australia foreign policy has to be one, non-nuclear, two, non-aligned, and three, I think it has to be, to go back to your devil's advocate argument, we have to be realistic that there are in fact problems out there and we need an armed defence force of some kind, but not one which is distorted towards the needs of our ally.
And finally, Richard, we'll have to let you go in a moment, but the title of the IPAN conference coming up in Perth next month is Sleepwalking into War. You've already hinted at it, and of course one doesn't wish to be alarmist about this, but in your estimation, just how dangerous is the current geopolitical environment, particularly in our part of the world, and how, to what extent is Australia sleepwalking into a potential major conflict with China?
I think the sleepwalking part is perfectly clear. It's very clear that there is a faction in the government and in the Defence Department which has got control of Australian defence and foreign policy, perhaps being partly resisted by Foreign Minister Wong, we're not quite clear, but which has aligned us with Washington in a way even more than we have before. And sleepwalking in the sense that there appears to be no serious assessment of the risks about this within government, and certainly not in consultation with the Australian public. How risky is it? I think we're at the early stages of the beginnings of a very serious move towards a new Cold War. And I think the thing that makes it dangerous for us is not what's actually happening externally at the moment. We're not in a situation like between Ukraine and Russia, for example. We're a long way from issues in the East China Sea with Taiwan and China. But rather that we are, the risk, the danger is that we are, in a sense, locked and cocked for a battle that we have no control over. And we will have no control over the initiation of it or the terms of our participation in it.
That was Senior Research Associate with the Nautilus Institute, International Relations Academic and Spokesperson for the Independent and Peaceful Australia Network, Professor Richard Tanter, speaking to us earlier today. And that IPAN conference coming up in Perth next week, a Sleepwalking into War, the IPAN 2024 conference is happening from Friday the 4th of October to the Sunday the 6th of October. Whole series of sessions. I was actually just having a look at the program on the website. Lots of stimulating topics about threats of war in the region and activism in response to it. Also sort of connecting sessions around Palestine solidarity work, nuclear waste. So lots of topics being discussed and something of a who's who of WA activism in terms of speakers and Senator David Shoebridge is speaking over from New South Wales, and newly independent Senator Fatima Payman, Sophie McNeil, former ABC journalist, Carmen Lawrence speaking. So well worth checking out. If you just do a Google search for IPAN or IPAN conference, it'll come up with the details, and you'll see on the website the opportunity to register for that conference coming up next month. You've got to love it. That was Cranky there with Australia Don't Become America, which just as a tipping off point in terms of, because we've got a little bit of time before the end of the show, and not to bore, at the risk of boring you with too much sort of theoretical, obscure internal left-wing debates, that song and also the interview that I conducted with Richard Tanter does raise some important and interesting questions that, yes, are partly of an intellectual interest and theoretical nature in international relations circles as well as sort of left-wing circles generally. And that is the question of independent Australian foreign policy and what that really means, as we discussed with Professor Tanter. Now, there's without going into the weeds of this too much, this is a long-standing debate on the Australian left and in Australian politics more generally, going back many decades. And what interpretation, which is actually a Maoist interpretation, although not exclusive to Maoists, says that Australia is actually a neo-colony of the United States, which to younger listeners, perhaps, that might sound, you know, quite peculiar, but I can tell you that that was quite a popular argument, you know, certainly in the 70s and 80s and into the 90s, that somehow, you know, Australia was equivalent to a colony, that it was essentially colonised by the United States, and that the quip was often, occasionally you still hear it, but you used to hear this all the time, that Australia's the 51st state. And probably that rhetoric reached its height, I would argue, under Bob Hawke. Now, Bob Hawke did, of course, very closely align himself with Reagan. He supported the American assault in Iraq, the first Gulf War. And so that sort of idea that, well, actually Australia is just the sort of embarrassing puppy dog poodle that follows in lockstep with everything Washington does, you know, very much held currency at that time. Not a great deal of time to argue a counter to that, but I would say that that's completely wrong in the sense that it's nuanced. Australia is dependent on the United States, you know, militarily and so forth. But here's the point: it's the Australian ruling class, the basically big business and the top end of town that sees benefit for Australian capitalism in that relationship with Washington. So that's really the point. They see benefit in terms of if they can operate, the Australian military can operate under an American umbrella, that makes life easier for Australian capitalists in places like Solomon Islands or throughout the Pacific in terms of expanding its sort of economic military footprint, you know, under the protection, if you like, or umbrella of the United States. In other words, it's not as though Canberra is having its arm twisted and being forced to sign those treaties, being forced to sign up to things like AUKUS and the $368 billion submarine package. It's seen as beneficial to Australia's economic and military interests. So, in other words, I don't think it's a sort of a simple delineation between so-called dependent foreign policy and independent foreign policy. Having said all that, you know, of course, a socially just, you know, foreign policy would look very radically different from what it is now. And if you think that's not possible in a world of power politics, just have a look at David Lange. If you don't know who that is, Google him. New Zealand Prime Minister in the 1980s, who successfully banned American nuclear warships from entering and docking in New Zealand harbours. I mean, that's an extraordinary thing. And guess what? America didn't subsequently bomb, you know, a Christchurch or Wellington or Auckland as a result. New Zealand actually paved the way in the 1980s for a genuinely independent foreign policy. So no excuse for Australia. And it is, yeah, clearly a source of shame that Australia has for so many years, you know, back the United States in from Vietnam to Iraq to Afghanistan, following that bloody murderous trail of United States imperialism all around the world, and surely we can do better as a country. Anyway, that's about all we have time for. Do stay tuned. Bobby's coming up next on RTRFM with Out to Lunch. It's been a pleasure to be with you as always. Don't hate the media, become the media, as we say every week. We'll see you next week.
Thank you for listening to this RTRFM podcast. RTRFM is a community organisation and relies on volunteer and listener support. Visit rtrfm.com.au for more podcasts and other great content, as well as details on how you can support the station. You can also download our app and access RTRFM anytime and anywhere on your mobile device.